go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Here we go, two minutes past the hour. A little bit late in getting all the packets passing and the molecules and the electrons partying and everything together. But, you know, hey, we're here. And that's really what matters in the long run, isn't it? I hope so. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll get that out of the way. I always presume that everybody knows that, but, you know, it's an arrogant presumption on my part. I realize that. So, it is the 21st day of June, 2017. It's also Wednesday, the 21st day of June, 2017. So, in fact, prayer meeting Wednesday falls on the summer solstice, my favorite day of the year. The winter and the summer and winter solstice are favorite days of the year for different reasons. The winter solstice means that the long, grinding, diminishing days of waning sunlight are finally over. And the summer solstice, well, there's a certain amount of sadness that comes with it. It's the longest day of the year. In the northern or the southern hemisphere, it's just that they're reversed one way or the other. You know all this. But I get kind of, not misty-eyed, no. But it's, there's something about the solstices because I think there's an argument to be made that on the solstices, we have a certain communion. I know I'm not in the chat room. I'm actually still tinkering with a computer, trying to get into the chat room. And not having just a hell of a lot of luck. Yeah, well, screw it. Let's go in this way. I'll get back to the solstice as soon as I get in the chat room. One of these days I'm going to get strangled on one of these cords. There. And that. And I'll be there in a minute. So, anyway. There's a certain communion, and not in the eat a magic cracker kind of way. Of the common human experience in the solstices. Because at least to my way of thinking, if there is any particular day, and we're going to dispense for the moment with the idea of a calendar, because there's all kinds of different ones. Hell, Stonehenge itself is a calendar. So too, the pyramid at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. The Maya, of course, were master calendaricists. More accurate than any calendar we other humans came up with up until the advent of the nuclear age. But the idea of the solstices is not merely related to the idea of sedentary humanity. I think there's an argument to be made that once we got down out of the trees, maybe even while we were still fighting with the vultures for what the jackals and hyenas didn't want, one of the first things we did in figuring out our conscious world was to know what the nature of the rising and the setting of the sun was. No, I don't mean like figuring out that it was a star in space and not a distant god, but figuring it, because, see, the winter solstice tells you that it might be safe to start eventually moving toward, if you're a hunter-gatherer band, of course, moving toward climbs further north or south, depending on which part of the planet you're on. And the summer solstice, that longest of all the days of the year, the summer solstice tells you that, indeed, it's going to get warm, it's going to get warmer, but the days themselves are going to get shorter. It's all downhill to the winter solstice from here on. This is the longest day of the year. God, as a kid, I loved this time of year. Because make sure you come home by dark. Hell, that meant I could be gone most of the day. Because the day was mostly day. Sedentary societies, and you need the solstices and the equinoxes in particular to set up planting and harvesting schedules. So I checked in, because I've been cutting brush like a darn fool. I checked in with my advisor in all things pagan, and she, a very good witch, informed me that, yes, indeed, fire is associated with the solstice, and that it's a good idea to have some fire-roasted food on the solstice. Well, look, no insult to whatever deities may be at play here, but marshmallows are food, at least nominally. And so if the idea, and she explained to me that the idea of a fire on the solstice is to extend and to perpetuate the long day, whereas the fire on the winter solstice is to invite more light. So tonight, after the program, as darkness falls, because it won't be dark entirely by the time I'm off the air here, as darkness falls, I'll light a little fire, and because I've been cutting so damn much brush, I'll be able to pull out maybe a forked stick, a pointed stick, and stick a few marshmallows on it, and once I get the fire going, roasty-toasty them in the blaze and propitiate whatever whatever natural nature deities, maybe just the collective consciousness of everything. And who knows what kind of goodness, or for that matter, you know, maybe nothing will come out except, you know, roasted marshmallows. Oh, to have some Kaneka sausage. That would almost be worth rolling the dice with my gallbladder and my pancreas and my spleen and all my other innards. Oh, if I had some Kaneka sausage to put on those pointed steaks. Yeah, it'd be, exactly. Steve from Georgistan, midweek utility chat room moderator, says, fire roasted yogurt? Yeah. Yeah, roasted tomato yogurt. How about that? Fire-roasted cucumber yogurt. Well, I mean, cucumber yogurt's kind of just tzatziki, isn't it? It's just not so much fun without the gyro stuff to put it on. Right. But I tell you what, we had ourselves a Jim Dandy prayer meeting Wednesday, fellowship hall dinner. We really, really did. The little old blue-haired ladies who run the fellowship hall kitchen let the little old blue-haired men, being as how it is the solstice, go out and play with fire. For one reason in particular. Yesterday, they sent the little old blue-haired men out to fire up the grill, and the little old blue-haired men made hamburgers. And then they brought them in, and the little old blue-haired ladies ground up the hamburgers, chopped them up, and started making spaghetti sauce. So here in the Fellowship Hall kitchen, we've got our own fire-roasted food, because then the little old blue-haired ladies in the Fellowship Hall kitchen took that there hamburger, added some sautéed mushrooms and onions and green peppers and some artichoke hearts to it, and then began putting the special little old blue-haired lady spaghetti sauce, tomato sauce to it. And this was all yesterday. And they cooked up great vats of vermicelli, angel hair, thin stuff. Mixed it all together with some mozzarella and some parmesan and some Parmigiano-Reggiano and some Romano. Set it in the refrigerator, let it get cold. And then for this evening's prayer meeting Wednesday dinner on the solstice, they took all that ice-cold spaghetti and they put it into a hot iron skillet and made skillet-fried spaghetti. Oh, the heavenly smell of it, the garlic, the onion, the green pepper. Oh, a little bit of red pepper flake in there just to perk it up. They asked me for permission, and I certainly gave it. And they went and grabbed a bottle of the cheap screw-top communion wine, put a little of that in the sauce yesterday. And so we had... We had deliberately made leftover skillet-fried spaghetti for Fellowship Hall dinner this evening. I asked for a little bit of the sauce and folded it into some yogurt and had yogurt marinara for dinner myself. Oh, there was garlic bread. Oh, it was so good. It really didn't call for any more sides than that. Oh, no. It was magic. God, my mouth's watering just talking about it. Try it sometime if you never have. It just your spaghetti from the day before, put it in the fridge, leave it there, and then put it in a nice hot iron skillet with a little bit of water in the bottom so that the water will immediately steam the spaghetti, the day-old spaghetti. You will not believe the flavor boost you get out of that whole process. And then the little old blue-haired ladies for dessert decided to try their hand at tiramisu, and I'd say they did a pretty passing fair job, because there wasn't so much as the fingernail of a lady finger left out of that entire pan, or multiple pans. And the deacons were a smacking of their lips and waddling extra proudly as they trundled their massive bulk up the couple of flights of stairs, where they then proceeded out to the parking lot to be a smoking with the sinners. Mercy sakes alive, I tell you what. And that's where I found them. That's where I find them every Wednesday, standing out there. I just kind of pull down the blinds there in the pastoral office on the fourth floor of the cathedral. And sometimes I peek down at them through the rose window of the cathedral, but never mind that. I'd say they got in a good chain smoking of four cigarettes with the sinners. And one of them tried to light up one of those little Swisher Sweets affairs, you know, the one with the sugared tip. Yeah, he knocked down a good inch and a half on it, puffing away. But then Sister Carol Baker appeared at the vestibule door, and I was surprised to find out that she has put a little stainless steel gargoyle on the end of the solar powered cattle prod. And his eyes glow all red and demonic when she presses the button, and the crackling starts in the air around it. And that got a real jump out of the deacons. It really, really did. And so they then applied feet to street and blew right past Sister Carol Baker, through the vestibule door, through the vestibule itself, past that bowl of desiccating butter mints, down the center aisle, and they're waiting for me now. They're waiting for you as well. They've gone to the table, and they've all picked up their heavy brass burgundy velvet lined offering plates. And lo and behold, they stand waiting. They stand waiting for the order from me to go out and begin passing the plates. And once everybody's got their head bowed and their little eyes closed, except, you know, keeping one scrunched open a little bit so they don't get hit with the plate. Yeah, as Sister Carol Baker did let me know, she said, they was moving a little slow in this here heat. I got a few of them to find Jesus in the parking lot. They do get inspired, the deacons do. Got to keep an eye on them. I mean, they've been elevated to a high lay position within the church, but daggum, you got to watch them extra double plus good close, or they'll be a backsliding for all they're worth. But they're waiting here. They got the heavy brass plates with the burgundy velvet lining and the PayPal button in the middle of it. And so I'm here in a moment. I'm going to call the minister of music up, and we're going to do the offertory hymn. And the plates will pass, and I can tell you, brethren and sistren, that it's a special prayer meeting Wednesday, because all we have to raise this evening is $100. We got a little bit ahead over the evening, thanks to the overnight crew. Thank you to Joan. That would be Sister Joan. And thank you to David in Vermont, Brother David. Thank you to Sister Marcy. And thank you to Brother Steve in Ohio. And thank you to Sister Nancy. We have, in fact, only $100 to raise for the evening. And that is inspiring indeed. Not very often we come into a prayer meeting Wednesday with only $100 to raise to stay even. So hopefully this will prove an inspiration, and we'll just immediately have 10 people at $10 in the congregation there as the music plays and the plate passes. Or one at 100, or hell, two at 100. Who knows? But hopefully we'll be able to meet the fundraising goal lickety-split. I've just been provided with the correct pronunciation in the Italian of tiramisu. Flavio tells me in Italian, repeat after me, tiramisu, my favorite dessert, Brother Flavio says. It means lay it on me, really. You know what? You could lay that stuff on me in a bathtub and I would eat my way out. Mm-hmm. Assuming the bathtub was clean, of course. So, brethren and sisters, with every eye closed and every head bowed, except, you know, watch out for the plate. Suckers are heavy and they hurt. I will ask the minister of music to step forward and lead us in the offertory hymn here on this summer solstice 2017, prayer meeting Wednesday.
And he said, it's time for you to leave behind the things of this world. The fine houses, the fancy cars, the flashy clothes, because we are all naked in the eyes of the Lord.
Stop! This man is clinically insane!
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen!
Amen!
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord!
Praise the Lord!
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah!
Hallelujah!
Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, mersey dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy dobby, a kiddly dobby too, wouldn't you? I love you. Welcome, brethren and sistren, to Prayer meeting Wednesday. On the horn. I'm a-calling on you now. Hop, glory, to get up off of your seats and onto your feet and wiggle and waddle and scoodle and squeesh and squeak and get on. Just be careful where you don't put it. It might have close quarters in betwixt the pews there, and we don't want to help. Glory, add any more to the meaning of the word pew as you're just trying to get out there to the center aisle and come on down that blood red aisle and fall upon your knees at the altar, brethren and sistren, and lay, amen, your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense of flowing through you from the server on high. I am Arch Pope, Uber Rabbi, Ultimate Imam, Animated Animist, Antagonized Agnostic, Vicarious Vicar, Maximum Metropolitan Bob Kincaid, and this here is Prayer Meeting Wednesday on Heck Glory the Horn. Amen and amen, worlds without end. Oh, brethren and sistren, you know, things is getting a mite, shall we say, warmish, and I don't mean weather-wise, over there in that part of Asia, which we persist in calling the Middle East. I mean, I look at a map, and the Middle East looks like it'd be about Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, that kind of thing, but no. Your Iraq and your Syria and your Israel and your, you get the, yeah. Well, brethren and sistren, we know now that, for instance, maximum Trump for life, Donald Trump, has turned over the decision-making about how many troops to keep in which countries to Secretary of Defense General Mad Dog Mattis. And he's decided we need to throw a few thousand more mamas and daddies, sons and daughters, and a few more aunts and uncles and sisters and brothers and cousins and neighbors and things like that. We need to throw a few more thousand of them into the Afghan meat grinder. Because one of these days, you know, we're going to win in Afghanistan. Because it's so easy to do there. And a story broke earlier today courtesy of USA Today that lets us know just how close to victory we truly are in Afghanistan. Oh, we're just right there. Because we've trained up an Afghan army that's just itching to support a Western-style nation state, and they are a fashion-forward Afghan army. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction recently completed an investigation of just how fashion-forward the Afghan army is. And it turns out that the Afghan army needed uniforms. I mean, this ain't ancient Greece or anything where you just send the hoplites marching into battle with their boyfriends and linked arm in arm with their 18-foot sarissas sticking out beyond the shields and march the phalanx through anything that stands in front of them. No. And all naked. Yeah, naked. And it's not like we're Celts or Greeks or anything. We don't send people into battle naked anymore. No. Instead, we send them in uniforms that we pay taxpayer dollars for. And in the case of the fashion-forward Afghan army, brethren and sistren, we gave the choice of uniform to the Afghan defense minister. Now, I know this is not something you and I sit around thinking about very often, but the United States military actually owns certain camouflage schemes, which we, you know, because they're designs, and designs can be copyrighted and, I guess, trademarked and folded and spindled and mutilated and it, what have you. And because the United States government owns those schemes, they are not as expensive to produce. But the Afghan defense minister didn't like any of those uniform print screens. Schemes. Isn't that screen printed? No. No, instead, the Afghan defense minister wanted a forest color pattern that turned out to be privately and proprietarily owned, thus leading the United States military, using money provided by you, me, we, the people of the United States, seeking to form that more perfect union, provide for the common defense, all of that stuff in the front end of the Constitution, to shell out something on the order of $28 million in the last 10 years, buying woodland forest camouflage uniforms for the Afghan army, when in fact only 2.1% of the entire land area of landlocked Afghanistan is of the type of, it's only 2.1% forest. So with the $28 million worth of taxpayer-paid-for uniforms, the Afghan army can only be camouflaged in 2.1% of the country. Now, I am no von Clausewitz, but I will suggest to you that if you get the entire Afghan army in the 2.1% of the country where they can hide in their forest camouflage, you've pretty well done the trick of encirclement, and there's not going to be an Afghan army for just very much longer, okay? Seventeen-page report detailing the squandering of $28 million taxpayer dollars. This is quite possibly the stupidest expenditure of money in the longest war in American history. You know, since the federal government started buying rifles that had Bible verses incised into the barrels. Shoot him in the back, Gomez. Mark 12:31. No. But no, we did that too. We really did. The rifle manufacturer put special Christian Bible verses on the barrels of the rifles so that they would better kill the infidels. Crusade, anyone? And apparently, John Sopko, who was, in fact, the Special Inspector General who wrote the report, upon being interviewed by USA Today, he had a certain appreciation for the absurdity of the situation. Special Inspector General John Sopko said, My concern is, what if the Minister of Defense liked purple or liked pink? Are we going to buy pink uniforms for soldiers and not ask questions? That's insane. This is just simply stupid on its face. We wasted $28 million of taxpayers' money in the name of fashion because the defense minister thought that the pattern was pretty. So if he thought pink or chartreuse was it, would we have done that? Why does everybody have to pick on pink? I for one, am fond of pink. It's just nice. And I damned well like purple, too, thanks. But even though I'm not von Clausewitz, and I'm not sitting here with my own personal copy of Von Kriege, I recognize you probably don't want to march an army into the field in pink and purple uniforms. Unless you're in a pink and purple landscape, of which there aren't just a shitload on planet Earth. Now, out there on Norblap 12, the whole planet, pink and purple, nothing but. Yeah, you'll want those pink and purple spacesuits for that. But the point is well taken. And the uniforms, by the way, also had to have special tailoring details. The Afghan defense minister wanted zippers instead of buttons. You know why you don't use zippers and you use buttons in military uniforms? So I'm told. I've never been in the military. Because when you're out in the field and Private Pyle goes off into some portion of the 2.1% of Afghanistan that consists of forest to take a wee, when he goes zzz, well, then your average Taliban, Mujahideen, whatever, hears that and shoots Private Pyle dead. Zzz, and you never get the zzz of the zipper coming up. Buttons are not noisy. Zippers are. It's the same reason, at one point in time, the U.S. military wanted to put Velcro on pockets. You know. Oh, brilliant! So, in total, in case you were wondering, keeping track at home or something, we have spent, you, me, we, us, we the people, trying to form that more perfect union and give Afghanistan one, too, that they don't want. We've spent $93 million on uniforms since 2007. Over the next decade, switching, according to the USA Today article, switching to a U.S. military-owned camo pattern would save around $71 million. Having been caught pink-handed, the Pentagon replied that, we need a cost-benefit analysis to determine whether there is a more effective alternative considering both operational environment and cost. I got a less costly alternative. Shh, don't tell anybody. Agent Fred, keep this one on the onde ole. Get the fuck out of Afghanistan. I know, crazy, right? Because, see, if we get out of Afghanistan, then the inscrutable Chinese will go running into Afghanistan, and there is a shit ton of precious rare earth minerals there, which someday, if we can get the barbarians who live there to quit blowing each other up over their imaginary friend, then we can steal their fucking minerals. And Afghanistan can become a participant in the worldwide resource curse. Look, you've got a lot of stuff that the developed world wants. We would like to mine it. Hey, Hindu Kush, we'll bring in Alpha Natural Resources, and the goddamn Hindu Kush will be the Hindu plane before you know what happened. Blast the bejesus out of it, peacefully, of course. Not in a non-hostile fashion. We'll poison the air, poison the water, and get all your wealth. See how it works? That's why we have to stay. That's why we have to throw, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 more fathers and mothers, sons and daughters, into the Afghan meat grinder. Because someday, some American extraction corporation might be able to make a shit ton of money, and golly, won't the shareholder coupon clippers be happy then? Oh, they'll look up and say, you know, all those soldiers that died in Afghanistan, they didn't die in vain. Look here, it's a dividend check. And so that brings it, and I know you're sitting there going, what has this got to do with prayer meeting Wednesday? Well, we've, you know, the Kenyan Muslim usurper completely ruined the military by letting LGBT people serve openly in it. I mean, you realize we haven't won a war since the Kenyan Muslim usurper in our White House started letting, you know, those people say that they were those people while they were in our military. Coincidence? I think not. And so it is that a Republican from Oklahoma stand by the name of Representing Steve Russell did an interview with Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins of the Family Research Council. Now, Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins is and always has been all worked up about all things homosexual. Oh, dear God, I hope Matt's not driving through the Castro District in San Francisco right now. Roll the windows up, Matt! Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins of the Family Research Council, there's not much homosexual that doesn't get him just positively wrought. And so he invites good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, amosexuals, Republicans, to come on his program and get all wrought with him. And in this case, it was Republican representing Steve Russell of Oklahoma stand who got wrought. He's right worried, Steve Russell is, about the Obama administration decision that said openly transgendered people could join the military. Mm-hmm. Trans men who want to go out and you know, kill for oil companies, and trans women who want to join up and support the global effort to defend capitalism. And while the policy has not been formally implemented, training continues in the United States Army for implementation of the policy in anticipation that it will happen on July 1, a scant 9 days from now. Well, representing Steve Russell of Oklahoma, Stan, he ain't happy. Oh, no. Having transgendered people in the military? Golly, Moses, oh, nobody knows the trouble we've seen.
This is something that will really cause a lot of confusion and problems for commanders, and it does nothing to promote our military in readiness, nothing at all.
Well, in fact, I would think it would hinder readiness when you look at...
It absolutely would hinder, and several of these vignettes, as you go through this proposed policy, it says...
Vignettes? Is that a trans thing? Whereas if it was, it would just be vins, or venues, if it was all butch and fully masculine, but if it's trans, it's vignette, because it's all, you know, girly, I don't know, but there's vignettes.
That commanders are given authority to make determinations on whether or not a soldier would be deployable based upon where they're at in this supposed chain of transitioning. Okay, so here's another vignette.
Yeah, hold on. Wait a minute before we go to the next vignette, if you don't mind. Commanders get authority to make determinations on whether or not a soldier would be deployable based upon where they're at in this supposed chain of transitioning. Isn't that kind of like a commander having the authority not to send somebody with appendicitis? I'm not comparing transition with a disease or an illness. What I'm trying to say is that a commander has the ability and the authority to determine who goes and who stays based upon the wellness of the overall wellness of the fighting unit. So you don't tell somebody with an inflamed appendix, a march soldier. No, you bring that, you treat the soldier so that the soldier will be at maximum effectiveness when it's time to go and do what soldiers do. Supposed chain of transitioning. Supposed transition. I tell you what, representing Russell, let's fire you up with, oh, I don't know, some estrogen and some progesterone and blast you with some anti-androgens and whatnot and see how supposed that transitioning becomes for you. Because I have a feeling there won't be anything supposed about it. But that's just another case of mean liberals encouraging violence. No, of course not. But that's not our only nightmare horror story of the trans army. Dun-na-na.
I decide I don't want to deploy to combat. I state that I'm suffering from gender dysphoria, which there is no criteria available for commanders to even know what this means.
Really? No data whatsoever? Nothing in the medical literature, the psychological literature, the psychiatric literature? Not a sausage whereby anybody can know what gender dysphoria is? Then how did Representative Russell even know to use the word? Well, maybe he had a prophetic gift of knowledge from Almighty God. No criteria for commanders to know, and so that's what's going to happen. But once this comes into effect, the whole new United States Army is gonna go all cowardly when they don't want to get sent to fight for rare earth mineral interests in Afghanistan, and they're all going to get all trans all of a sudden. The only problem if you've just said that trans people can be in the military, then you can transport the trans people. Jesus! These people. Wouldn't it be a lot easier just to acknowledge that people are who people are? I wonder how representing Russell Ruffel feels about, say, that Navy SEAL who did multiple tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan and all that Navy SEAL stuff, and then got out and said, oh, by the way, I'm transgendered. I mean, I'm a big old bulky guy and work out with weights and everything, but really, the woman. And immediately got medical help to start transitioning once she was out of the military. And then, of course, probably the most famous transition in recent memory, no, not Caitlyn Jenner, but Chelsea Manning. You want to talk about courage? By the way, reports out in the last couple of days indicate that the federal government lied through its goddamn teeth, claiming that Chelsea Manning's disclosures, for which she served brutal imprisonment, the federal government said, it harmed national security. Nah, a couple of reports in the last day or so say, nope, no harm to national security whatsoever from what Chelsea Manning did. Whoopsie. Well, at least they enjoyed, at least they got a little charge out of torturing her. So there's that. So a question, and I apologize for not knowing her name or not remembering her name. But the Navy SEAL who transitioned, you reckon she would have gotten out of the military if she could have transitioned and stayed in the military and maybe passed on, helped to pass on the knowledge, training, and information that she had to up-and-coming SEALs? Isn't that deemed sort of valuable in military terms? You want to have your lifers and your upper echelon sergeants, because that's who the military really runs on, and your chiefs and things like that, right? Yeah. So, getting back to representing Russell, and when I look at everything going on around me, it amazes me that this is what representing Russell is really worked up about. And I would hazard a guess that if this is what you're really worked up about, then maybe there's something underlying it all that has you, really worked up, if you know what I mean. So we're at that place where we don't know. The commanders don't know what gender dysphoria is, right? Yeah. So let's pick it up there.
Dysphoria, which there is no criteria available for commanders to even know what this means, and then I'm in a trick bag where I have to make some determination based upon some social ideological agenda that the vast majority of the military is not focused on. They're focused on readiness and combat readiness and the defense of our republic. And now you've got a construct where soldiers who don't want to deploy can throw this monkey wrench in the machinery, and you're underwriting it with your tax dollars.
Well, how do you do? Meanwhile, we've already underwritten $28 million worth of forest camo, proprietary forest copyrighted camo pattern uniforms for the Afghan military. You know, this creepy transphobe makes it sound like military members who are trans are going to try to, I don't know, go into a theater of operations in a sequined ball gown that they have to be sewn into, like Marilyn Manson getting ready to sing Happy Birthday to Jack Kennedy. And that's one of the things that attaches to the right-wing phobia for people different from them. They have no experience of the life whatsoever, so they impose their bigotries and their fears onto it, absent anything even remotely resembling knowledge or understanding. So, Representative Russell, I guess, says to himself, well, you know, if I was trans, I'd probably want to go into ballet, into battle in a goddamn ballet tutu with the little headpiece and look like I'm in fucking Swan Lake. That's what I would do. That's what I do on Saturday night when the wife's away. I mean, Jesus. They make assumptions about sex. They make assumptions about attire. They make assumptions, none of which are supported by actual demonstrable, empirical knowledge and or data. This is nothing but bigotry-driven, fear-driven speculation. Understand, there is not one instance of a, quote, construct where soldiers who don't want to deploy can throw a monkey wrench into the machinery and you're underwriting it with your tax dollars. It's the military, for Pete's sake. They're regimented. They got rules and regulations and goddamn, the Marine Corps calls what it wears on, not the pants part, they call that a blouse. Now, out in the civilian world, men wear shirts and women wear blouses. It's a language thing. Unless you're a Marine. Then you, big studly Marine, also wear a blouse. And I don't know which side the buttons go up. At one point in time, I don't think anymore, but at one point in time, the United States military, I think it may have been the Army Air Corps before the birth of the Air Force, wore pink pants. No shit. They were kind of gray, but they had a little bit of pink to them. Pink pants. Didn't seem to interfere with our air superiority over either the South Pacific or, you know, Europe. And several years ago, when there was a company arose that dealt in that sort of retro vintage style clothing, those trousers looked rather dashing. And the Army Air Corps personnel of yesteryear tended to agree. But no. The Republican Party and Representative Russell is all worried about them trans soldiers. Ain't Christianity just beautiful? It is 7 p.m. here on the in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone, and I will simply note that, as I announced it, we got $100 to raise this evening. I was hoping maybe it would have been raised by now so that I wouldn't have to mention it again, but we haven't, so I got to mention it again. So we got $100 to raise. And we got a whole bunch more prayer meeting Wednesday. May I also point out along the way that the military organization most successful in Afghanistan had those successes while wearing dresses. They had successes while wearing dresses. I'm talking, of course, about the army of Alexander the Great. And by the way, they were pretty gay. Jesus, I feel like Uncle Arthur from Bewitched has hit me with a rhyming spell. Sister Carol Baker noting, all you need to know about a soldier is, one, have they received the appropriate training? And two, are they willing to follow all lawful orders? And three, will they protect and defend the United States of America? And four, are they physically able to perform their duties? Once you know that, then everything they need to know about their character is right there. But see, the GOP are a bunch of twisted goddamn weirdos. And they can't help wondering about what's between the legs of a given member of the military. And once they start wondering about that, they wonder what they do with them. And how they do with them, what they do with them. Because repression, neo-Calvinism, sexual hang-ups, and Jesus, will somebody just get these right-wing assholes laid? But then again, they probably don't. No, it's not even that. It's not fun if it's not dirty to them, because they've been dipped by the heel in the idea of sex being dirty. So if it's not, if it doesn't have an aspect of forbiddenness to it, well, you know, don't fuck it. Yeah, if you get my meaning. So I thought between the ramp up in Afghanistan and the uniforms and the right-wing freak out over trans soldiers, I thought we had the beginnings of a pretty nice prayer meeting Wednesday. As Steve, a member of the Fraternity of Steve, writes in, subject line, cow flop flap. Anyone who ever wore a uniform knows that, with few exceptions, military personnel don't greatly give a fuck about issues sexual. COs, commanding officers, with attitudes running against discipline and morale, don't get too far or stay COs for long. For reasons that should be obvious. This is political manure of the highest quality. I would point out, or the lowest quality, depending on how one views things. Steve, in China. Carol Baker pointing out, brother Steve Scalise got saved by a black lesbian. Did he ask her what she does in the bedroom before she took a bullet and helped save his life? You see, in a crisis, those things just aren't up for debate. No, and if you are a good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, amosexual Klan sympathizer like Steve Scalise, it is fitting and proper for a black lesbian police officer to take a bullet for you, because you're Steve Scalise and she's not. See how it works. Let's see. We have, speaking of Steve Scalise, we have much more to discuss. Much, much more. And I'm tripping. I've got the studio about half taken apart right now. And I've got my feet all hung up in all kinds of, speaking of hung up, in all kinds of cords. It'd be kinky if it weren't so boringly technical. Anyway, We'll take a break. Maybe somebody along the way will knock down some of the fundraising so that we can, so that I can shut up about that. Sorry, I'm looking for just looking for a little something, something for a break. This is going to be so nice when I get the fab machine installed. I don't want to go with anything obvious. You know what? Sometimes you just can't go wrong. With the Stones. This is the Head On Radio Network. This is Conversation Radio. I'm Bob Kincaid. Yeah, like I said, there's never a bad time for the Stones. Title track to the 1978 album, Some Girls. And it is prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn. I confess, or I have a confession to make. I had to jump outside the studio to see what was going on. A great kindness is being done right now. You know, I've been telling you all that, all this. Weed eating an acre is a long proposition. And lo and behold, one of the nice neighbors just showed up with a brush hog. Somebody saw me out there swinging that weed eater and said, "Yeah, we got to help this guy." So it's nice when little neighborly things like that happen. And so what I was hearing, and what I maybe you heard, that low pitched sort of rumble was the rumble of a brush hog. So that, if you hear it, is what it is. It's really quite cool. So anyway, it is 13 minutes past the hour on this summer solstice, 2017. Brother Reverbo has wished the blessings of the possum goddess upon us all. Thank you, Reverbo. All deities are both welcome and unwelcome here at one and the same time. Do we need to debrief on the whole John Ossoff, Karen Handel thing? Stealing a line from Michael in Madison. I think it was Michael in Madison that I saw earlier today. You know, Karen Handel thanked the President of the United States for her victory. Does that mean that he is now Handel's Messiah?
Ah!
Yeah. I think that was Michael in Madison. Cowbell for that. But there has been a full broadcast day of hand-wringing and pearl-clutching over the fact that a Democrat didn't win in a traditionally, really, really traditionally Republican district in Georgia, the northern part of Atlanta. Now, you may recall a couple of nights ago that Steve from Georgistan rang up and said, "Y'all, John Ossoff's going to lose. These Republicans are not going to let this seat go to a Democrat." But nonetheless, the professional pundit class was all over the television all day today talking about how bereft, how crushed the Democrats must be because they didn't win a seat that the last time it was won by Republicans was won by like 23 points. And then you've got the people on our side of things who say, "Well, you know, hey, we only lost... We only lost by 5 points. That's a lot less than losing by 23 points. We can call that a moral victory." You do that, sunshine. Moral victories go in the L column, just like getting beat 1,000-0 goes in the L column. If you get in baseball, if you get beat 3-2. With a 3-run shot in the bottom of the ninth, with two on, and a 3-2 count, and one and the shot goes over the wall. You know what? Even though you led the game for 8 2/3 innings, you lost. It's a loss. It's not a moral victory to win the game for 8 2/3 innings. I mean, I was in the stands at Mountaineer Field when the Mountaineers had a moral victory against Miami, the University of Miami, and back when it was good. And the University of Miami, we pushed them all over the field for the better part of four quarters of football. And then at the very end, we were pushed back against our own end zone. And instead of snapping the ball out of the end zone and taking the safety, Don Nealon, strategic genius, tried to actually punt the ball from deep in his own end zone. This did not work. And even though we had kicked Miami all over the football field for four solid quarters of football, by the end, Miami had more points than we had. And so we had to call that a loss. Yes, loss. Right. And that's what it was in the Georgia 6th last night. Scott and Punky pointing out John Ossoff raised a record-breaking $23 million for his fight to win the seat. He might just as well have blown the entire pile of cash on lottery scratch-offs for all the good it ultimately did anybody. Precisely. And so today it was, why do you suppose he lost? I mean, it was 5 points. Why do you suppose he lost? Gosh, I don't know. 5 points. 5-point margin. Now, we discussed on this program the fact that both campaigns disavowed and condemned the ad that said that left-wing extremists are hunting Republicans to kill them, and that if John Ossoff gets elected, it will only get worse. Yeah, right. Both sides condemn the ad. But, and there's no getting around this part, that ad inured to the benefit of one candidate, namely Karen Handel. Not a goddamn mention all day long in the for-profit media about the fact that, well, in a race that's tight, a filthy ad like that will motivate a certain number of voters who will make double damn sure that they get out and that they vote for the Republican, no matter who or what the Republican is. I mean, in the primary, Karen Handel got 19% of the vote to John Ossoff's 49.50%. Didn't matter. These are the sons and daughters, the grandsons and granddaughters of people who were part of what used to be called the Solid South. Back in the days when the Solid South was solidly Democratic. Back in the day when Jim Crow was real. Back in the day when voter suppression was really out in the open. When there were literacy tests for voting that involved writing one's name on wax paper with a ballpoint pen or being able to read a Chinese restaurant menu, you know, in Chinese. The South was solidly Democratic. Along comes the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and shortly thereafter, the Solid South begins to crumble. And then long about 1980, you get the phenomenon, the bullshit phenomenon that was just pure unmitigated racism called the Reagan Democrat. And since that day, those Reagan Democrats have become, you know, conservative Republicans. Because they didn't change. They're still the same people. They were deeply conservative Southern voters who voted Democrat, and they just changed their name to Republican and remained deeply conservative, bigoted, racist, homophobic Southern voters. But it didn't fit anybody's narratives in the for-profit media today to say, look, 52% of the people who voted in the Georgia 6th election agree with Karen Handel that it would be better that a child that doesn't have parents continue to have no parents at all than have parents who are gay. Because they agreed with that. They signed on with that. They signed on with the idea that it is better for a child not to have any parents at all and live in what is frequently the hell of foster care than to have two women or two men who love them deeply, care for them, take care of them, and provide them an upbringing with something resembling a little bit of hope. Nope. 52% of the voters in the Georgia 6th Congressional District think it's better off for those little monsters to stay in foster care. Because, you know, they're not in the womb anymore, so they're not so the Republicans aren't so quite so all-fired pro-life about them. And 52% of the voters who showed up yesterday and in early voting in the Georgia 6th Congressional District also signed on with the notion that they think that the liberals are coming, just a wave of San Francisco, of gun-wielding San Francisco Democrats are going to come in and start mowing them down any minute. It'll be like Sherman all over again. Right? So, I mean, are we over this? If you're not, tell me. We can work through this. I'm not yelling at you. But we can. We can work through this. If you're not over this, if you haven't realized that yesterday was a great, big, overhyped, media soap-selling exercise, commercial capitalist election entertainment complex, nothing burger, call. Because we can work through this. You know the numbers. The stress line, area code 304-663-4676. That's 304-663-HORN. The other number, 304-574-8178. 574-8178. And then from anywhere on the planet, and we've got someone on the Skype line right now. From anywhere on the planet, Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. If you've never done it before, just send me a contact request, and we will be engaged in some Jim Dandy conversation, just like we're about to have with Clarity. Hey, Clarity.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing today?
I'm surprisingly okay.
You know, solstice and winter solstice are two of my favorite holidays. I think I've said that I just moved into this house in October, and whoever set the plans down the house and the windows, how they're cut. At the winter solstice, it comes through one window and shines all the way through into my kitchen. And today, it shined all the way down my bedroom hall. Like, it's my own little Stonehenge kind of thing there.
Somebody was paying attention when they built that house, Clarity.
It makes me think that there's more to this place. It's going to be 70 years old next year, and it was owned by a African American Baptist minister by the name of Greenwood Luster. And I kind of feel his presence around here sometimes.
Do you feel the need to speak in tongues, or I mean?
No, I want to shout. I want to sing. You know, with the big old Baptist. You know.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, thank goodness I live alone.
I don't know that one. You let go. There was almost a little bit of Ethel Merman in that "I want to sing" there, Clarity. Hide not thy light under a bushel.
Oh, don't get me started.
You want to give us a couple of bars that there's no business like show business?
There's no business like show business, like no business I know.
Oh, wait a minute. I don't think we've ever had an Ethel Merman cowbell before.
I'm due. I got one on after the show Monday, I think. You gave me a cowbell on Twitter.
Yeah, that was a Twitter cowbell, yes.
Yeah. But I also wanted to say that I share that sense of summer melancholy that it's, you know, it's a slide all the way into darkness from here on, you know. We're at the pinnacle.
Ain't going to get no better.
No, it isn't. And I usually do have an August melancholy. I call it the midsummer, you know, malaise. And, yeah. But I dodged the code warning today. The guy had the paper all written out, assuming that I owned the lot next door to me. And ironically, it's owned by a landscaping company. And it's all overgrown fire hazard. So I guess it's kind of like the plumber's wife that has the leaky faucet that never gets fixed.
Yeah.
But they're really cracking down here. You know, we're the largest city in Eastern Oregon, all 17,000 of us here. And we just hired a full-time code enforcement officer. So you can only have one derelict car on your property now. So all these people that have, you know, cars back to when their grandparents were driving, that, you know, you don't take them to the junkyard, you just park them out in the back.
Put them up on blocks and part them out.
Well, I guess that's what we're talking about. And it's dry here, and we don't salt the roads. So, you know, some of these late 40s, early 50s bodies are going to be, you know, worth some money to a collector. But anyway, they're starting to crack down on people. And our drummer had a property that he had just bought the property because it was in Lane and he got a good deal on it. But he hasn't done any work on it. And he got slapped with an $800 fine because the place wasn't boarded up enough so that children couldn't get in there and play. But geez, Bob, that was the fun stuff, is to getting into old houses and getting into trouble.
Oh, shucks, yeah.
Yeah. And luckily, we never start any fires, knock on wood, you know, and all of all our mischief. And I think that's what they're worried about, you know, some kid getting in there and doing something like that, because
Right. Everything's
around here real dry. You know, there's no rain grace pretty much, except for maybe a couple months out of the year.
Yeah, I checked. We've got a sign as you come into town or go out of it, depending on how you're looking at things. We've got a sign that tells one what the fire risk is for the day and reminds us that outdoor burning is banned between 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. daily. But from 5 p.m. to 7 a.m., I guess you burn the county to the ground. I'll be honest. I'm sure there's some sort of rational reason for it, but I haven't sussed it out yet, Clarity, because it seems to me you'd want to do your burning at a time when your fire departments would be sort of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. But who the hell am I?
Well, it might be, or just something that ran through my mind just now with all the volunteer stuff, you know, that they're doing it on a shoestring. That maybe all the firemen are at their day job, so they just are trying to cut down day fires when they don't have anybody that can get off work.
because we are, you know, we're volunteer firefighters. That's what we've got around here.
Yeah.
So,
well,
but, you know, the other thing about Appalachia is the wind tends to pick up at night.
Yeah.
So it just seems, well, like I said, I'm sure there's a rational reason. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah, the local scuttlebutt now is they're going to have a rainbow gathering in Malheur National Forest this year. And I don't know if you know about the rainbow gathering.
The rainbow, you know, family?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all the people in, you know, in my little activist group are saying, well, we can't afford all those extra services. You know, we're in Walden's district and we can't, you know, have all these fringe things. And it's like they do pretty good job considering how many of them there are to, you know, to keep clean up after themselves and everything. And then, of course, there's the people that are just like, why don't they, you know, camp somewhere else?
Well, they have been known to run afoul of some indigenous groups from time to time. I'm aware of that.
Okay.
Because somewhere in Northern California that I saw where they went tromping off across a meadow that was not supposed to be walked on at all.
Okay.
Because they were trying to get it to return to a state of nature, and it just didn't play out so well.
Well, the other thing that I found out today is our code enforcement officer is a tree hater. I pointed down the street, and I don't know if you noticed those trees in a lot of my pictures I post. It's a locust. It's a tree that they planted way back in because they're drought resistant.
Oh, I know from locusts. Yeah. My father battled them all during my childhood because, you know, they'll come, they have seed pods.
Yes.
They seed, but they also come up from the root structure.
Yeah. Well, that's why they're drought resistant. They can really expand the roots way out, you know.
And they're hard as nails. They make great fence posts.
Yeah.
And they will wreck your sewer line.
Yeah, well, and that's what I'm probably going to be dealing with. But anyway, the street that I'm living on is paved, but it's not, there's no sidewalks or anything. And in the master plan, they want to bring it up to quote unquote code, which would bring the street right up like within about 6 feet of the front of my house because I'm in the industrial area here, which had cut about 30 feet off the front of my lot. But I haven't gotten word back from the city planner if that's, you know, when and if that's going to go. But I'm not going to do anything with the front of my property if they're, you know, going to pave it right up.
Well, that seems a bit extreme, Clarity. 30 feet?
Well, all the other businesses are flush with my property. The setback is about 30 feet from the road. And I asked him, you know, how far the setback was going to be. And he said, well, where are the power lines? And I said, they're about 30 feet back from the road. And he goes, well, that's probably where the sidewalk's going to be. And anyway, I mentioned that to the code enforcer. And he goes, yeah, I wish the railroad, which owns the other side of the street, would cut down all those locust trees. And it's like, if they did that, then all I'd see is warehouses and, you know.
Yeah.
And in the winter, it's pretty bleak, but this time of year, it's green.
Yeah.
You know.
Thorny little bastards, too, those locust trees.
Oh, they're not climbing trees.
Wait a minute. It's a two cowbell night for Clarity.
Oh, wow. Well, I feel special, Bob.
That was just so perfectly timed. Oh, they're not climbing trees. To climb a locust tree once.
They're not good for climbing, no. But they have the best honey. If you can put a set of beehives out along a locust, oh, man, they make the best honey.
Oh, because they've got those lovely little white blossoms.
And they're sweet. You can, you know, I mean, the flowers themselves are good to, you know, if you got the time.
And the inclination to shinny up the thorn-covered locust tree to get at the blossoms.
Well, that's
why you let the bees do it.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm glad I do have, you know, bees around.
Oh, absolutely.
That's right.
One of the purposes behind the clearing of Bob Acre here is to maybe by this time next year be the proud owner of a rear-tine tiller. Being how mine got stolen several years ago, and start having
a
garden.
So you have dirt?
I have dirt. I have really nice dirt. The area where my grandmother's garden was has lain fallow for years.
Oh.
And if I put up like 18 feet high electric fences, I might be able to keep the Bambies out of it.
Oh, that's right. You got scavengers.
I have rats with antlers. That's what I have.
Yeah, they're pretty bad around here. We've got them in the city limits.
But you know, you mentioned bees, and there was just this one little grace note moment back when the children were tiny. I had planted Silver Queen corn. And that stuff, I don't know what I did, but I did it right. That stuff got 9 feet tall.
Whoa.
The corn was as high as an elephant's eye. I mean, I walked through, you know, me, show tunes. I can't carry a tune in a bucket, but I was walking those corn rows singing, the libretto from Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And the corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it's going, I think it's growing straight up to the sky. That's the end of me singing for the evening. I'm no Ethel Merman. But there was this thing that happened when the corn tasseled out and the silk was on and the ears were on. Every bee in three counties, it seemed like, came to my corn patch. And you could just hear it. You could step outside, and it was humming back there.
Oh, we're playing this Saturday. We're playing an event called the Lavender Festival. And you want to talk about the sound of bees humming as you walk through these lavender fields? It's amazing.
You've got lavender fields? I bet those are beautiful.
Oh.
Where'd you go, Clarity?
Opening once a, it's a benefit for Agape House.
Oh, nice.
It's a nonprofit that does outreach to, it has a women's shelter, and then they have a food bank, and it's a real good deal.
So you'll probably be a little bit better received than you were at the place where you played one song and they got cranky.
Well, they were. I finally decided that they were just trying to duck the rainstorm that was headed their way, not to think that they are all just a bunch of grouchy meth heads at the end of a long weekend.
And you know what? Somewhere out there, if Grouchy Meth Heads is not either an alt-punk country band or a straight-up punk band, the universe is off-kilter. I may have to shoot. I can't play a lick of anything, but me and Ferg may have to start a band just to call it Grouchy Meth Heads.
Well, or you could spell it. You could spell it like methods, except to have a silent H, you know, kind of thing. Methods.
Or we could put, two H's in it and call. No, somehow it could be Grouchy Meatheads. But Grouchy Methods.
Well, I was pleased also to see, and I had heard you say that, you know, you had a theater background, a liberal arts background, and I've. You've kind of inspired me to get back deeper into my wordism, that you're a believer in the word and a lover of the word. That's an inspiration. But anyway, you've never sang to me before, Bob, and I wanted to give you one of these.
Oh, my own little cowbell. Thank you, Clarity.
So it's a three cowbell conversation today. You made my day, and happy solstice to you, Bob. I'll move on.
Well, I'm so glad you called in, and I'm so glad we had a. I think I can safely hazard a guess that there is not a single radio program, be it progressive, conservative, or any other form. I doubt if even Garrison Keillor's replacement has had a conversation today about locusts, the trees, not the bugs,
and that dueling cowbells.
Exactly, Clarity. You have yourself a lovely evening.
Thank you, Bob. You've lifted me.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
Oh, locust trees. And my goodness gracious, cowbell. Although I have to admit, Reverbo used to bring a different bell. And every now and then I would get a ding from Reverbo, but it was more like the bell it was more like a counter bell. The ka-ting, you know, one of those, the service bell at the meat counter or whatever. But this is, you know, this is what makes it all worth doing. So I got a sort of an amen from Randy in PA. That Silver Queen is so sugary good. It is. You can eat it right off. Just to hell with cooking it. I mean, it's, oh, wow, is it good. And so that's kind of an ambition for next year. I have to be careful where I plant because of the leach field. I can't dig down into that and screw it all up. But, take that Silver Queen and just roast it. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And then the good butter and maybe a little bit of Old Bay. Somewhere, Todd in South Carolina stands going, yeah. Oh, Old Bay, the butter. Yeah, oh, yeah. And speaking of, I mentioned Todd. There was a congressional election in South Carolina last night that had all of the chattering pundit class saying, oh my, because the Democratic challenger came within 3 percentage points of winning that South Carolina race. Guess what? The Democratic challenger, former Goldman Sachs executive. I don't necessarily know what that means or that it means anything, but it means something. Meanwhile, note coming in from James. Subject line, Reagan Democrats. Those first and second generation Southern Republicans are still cashing those FDR money checks and telling them liberals to keep their damn dirty hands off their Medicare. And that is so true. And that is why I say that the primary motivating factor in Karen Handel's victory was the fact that you can count on a Southern voter to be staunch. And this is something that goes back 150 and more years. If you tell a Southerner of a certain type to do X, they will turn the world upside down to do X, whether it be marching into a hail of gunfire at Gettysburg, whose anniversary is coming up shortly, or whether it be voting for FDR, or whether it be voting for a greasy-headed old B-movie actor because he's dog-whistled you to let you know that he don't think much of the black folks either. So you're absolutely correct, James. Michael with a question. Subject line, Georgia voter turnout. I'm just curious, what was the voter turnout in Georgia yesterday? Did it break 50% or was it the same dismal 30 to 40%? Well, that's the funny thing. Everybody was saying, oh my God, voter turnout has been huge in the Georgia 6th Congressional District special election. Absolutely amazing turnout. Oh, a lot going on down here, Fred. Yeah. The unofficial turnout in a district with about 526,000 registered voters. The unofficial turnout for the Georgia 6th Congressional District, 49%. Not quite 50. So, gosh, there were a lot of people who stayed home, didn't bother. Who are those 50%? It's the same question we ask about the 48% or however many that stayed the hell home this past November. Now, I'm sure some of them were people. Look, what I said about being staunch a minute ago, if you hang an R behind somebody's name, and this isn't just a Southern thing, this is kind of a national thing. It's as equally applicable in Wisconsin or Minnesota as it is in Georgia, Alabama, or Tennessee, or Mississippi. If you hang an R behind somebody's name, there is a certain contingent that hell or high water, or a combination of both, frogs and locusts and rivers of blood into the mix, will get out. And they will beat your ass. Know why? Because we don't do that. Democrats don't do that. Democrats stay home if they're not excited enough about the candidate. Democrats stay home if the candidate doesn't meet some threshold of ideological purity. Democrats stay home if the temperature doesn't reach a certain height, or if three raindrops fall in a circle 2 feet in diameter. Oh, goodness me. But Republicans show up. And one of these days, if we ever decide that we want to win elections, maybe our side will too. Maybe our side will understand. Hey, look, okay, so I mentioned the former Goldman Sachs executive in South Carolina that came within 3 percentage points of beating the Republican in Mick Mulvaney's old district. Here's a question. And I welcome all answers. I'd be happy to have an answer from, say, a member of the Sparkle Fart Powered Unicorn Cavalry Purity Brigade. Would you rather have a Democrat who was a former Goldman Sachs executive in that seat, who could provide a vote to, say, it's too late now, but save 23 million people's health care? Or would you rather have the Republican? Or would you just stay home and say, someday we'll have somebody ideologically pure enough to be worthy of my vote? And, you know, for the Hillary Democrats and the Bernie-crats and you know, the really wild-eyed progressive liberals like me, the question applies. Would you have felt good if in that race the Democrat had won, even though the Democrat was a former Goldman Sachs executive? And I'm not telling you... how to feel about this. I want to know how you feel about this, because I don't necessarily have any answers. In the postmortem for John Ossoff, it was there has been more stupidity in analysis of that election than I've seen since November 9th. Of last year. The mother of all stupid, however, had to be the statement that if John Ossoff had only been a little bit more like Zell Miller, no shit. Remember when Zell went nuts? What was it, in 2000? Democrat who became a loyal Bushy? Yeah, one genius said that if only John Ossoff had campaigned a little bit more like Zell Miller, it could have been oh so different. And then there's the contingency. Well, you know what? You know what this proves? This proves that Nancy Pelosi's got to go. Goddamn Nancy Pelosi. Because, of course, there were buku bajillion million dollars spent by dark money, outside PACs, groups, what have you, in the Georgia 6th Congressional District, saying John Ossoff is just a little toe sucker for Nancy Pelosi. She'll come here and impose her gay San Francisco liberal values on you and take away your guns so that the liberals can hunt you. I guess with bows and arrows, because liberals don't like guns either. No, whatever. Nancy Pelosi. Bruga, bruga. And so naturally, there's a contingent out there. Oh, goddamn, Nancy Pelosi's got to go. Because, you know, Nancy Pelosi's got to go because the Republicans don't like Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
Response from Michael. Mike U. 49%. Well, then, that explains it. And you did a great job explaining why Democrats stay home. I told one of these fundraising emails, my donation isn't going to mean a shit when people can't get off their ass to vote because the candidate isn't correct enough or something like that. Our buddy, the Angry Indian, says, how about, and I addressed this a little bit earlier, but let's do it again. How about the vicious and fake liberal terrorism attack ads against the Democrat in that state? Why is the DNC not raising that moral ethical issue? Because it's pointless. Because it's already been condemned in the strongest possible terms. But Karen Handel won by 5% angry, proving that those ads work, and the only thing that matters is that those ads work. In a world of elections that are decided by 5 points or less, those ads can mean the difference between defeat and victory. And see, Republicans want to win. Republicans want to win at all costs. Democrats want to win if we can do it fair and square and according to Marcus of Queensberry rules. Democrats look on in shocked wonder at that scene from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid where Butch goes through the rules of how the fight's going to go down. We don't want it bad enough. We don't want it bad enough to show up. We don't want it bad enough to understand that the perfect is the enemy of the good. We don't want it bad enough to run the same sleazy filth against them that they run against us. I mean, I mentioned something at the beginning of the program. After she said it, The airwaves should have been flooded with ads saying, Karen Handel just said that children without parents are better off without parents than having gay parents. I mean, I saw emails, I saw Facebook posts. But guess what? Getting shit in front of people's eyeballs around TV screens still matters. Came out after the November 8th debacle disaster. Hillary, with all her bajillions of dollars, didn't run ads in what was it, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, until the last 2 weeks. Because some genius said she didn't need to. You got this one, Hills. We don't want it. I mean, we want it if it can be a nice, fair fight. But in large part, we don't want it. It would have been a big deal to snatch that seat in North Atlanta. It wouldn't be as big a deal as, say, taking a seat in South Carolina, where Rock Hill is the biggest town in that district. But it would have been a big deal. It wouldn't have been as big a deal as, say, unseating a Louis Gohmert or a Steve Cantaloupe's King. But it would have been a big deal. And so we've also got, you know, we've got some learning to do here. Out in Montana, Rob Quist, who was more on the Bernie side of the spectrum, lost by 6, if you count in the Libertarian candidate, lost by 12. Georgia 6th, John Ossoff, more of a kind of middle-of-the-road vanilla Hillary kind of candidate, lost by 5. And the for-profit media pundits were all, what they needed is an economic message. It's an economic message is what they need. I'm sorry. What was Karen Handel's economic message? That if orphan children don't have gay parents, they'll go to work sooner? Huh? So, I mean, there are lessons here. Montana and Georgia taught us two things. That there is a certain element of Republican voter who can be, will, and is motivated by things like strangling a reporter. Lügenpresse! Or terrorizing the electorate with the idea of Nancy Pelosi machine-gunned and bandoliered up like Rambo marching through Cobb County. By the way, there are there's Cobb County, Fulton County, and DeKalb County. There is a mass transit system in Atlanta. It's called MARTA, M-A-R-T-A, the Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority. The racists will tell you that it stands for Moving Africans Rapidly Through Atlanta. I heard that plenty when I lived there eons ago. And guess where MARTA doesn't go, or at least it didn't used to. Maybe Steve can update me on this. MARTA doesn't go to Cobb County because Cobb County busted their little white asses to make sure that MARTA trains didn't go to Cobb County. And guess what? In Cobb County, Georgia, the Karen Handel total was plus 15. So I think the picture becomes clearer. And maybe the next time, if there's a race that Democrats purport to really, really, really want, if it looks like the polling is within 2 or 3 points, have a shadowy pack, super pack, with money so dark it pulls in light from outside, run an ad that's absolutely filthy and disgusting and scurrilous against the other side. We used to understand how to do that. There's the old story of LBJ telling his, maybe it's apocryphal, telling his campaign manager to put out a statement saying that LBJ wanted to know if his opponent had stopped having sex with farm animals. And as the story goes, the manager said, LBJ, I can't do that. There's not a word of truth in it. LBJ just laughed and said, yeah, I know. I just want to hear him deny it. LBJ won. As odious and filthy as he was, George Wallace, when he first began running for statewide office, was actually deemed to be the more moderate candidate on race. And in that contest, he got excoriated by his opponent for not being hateful enough to people of color. And after Wallace lost, he said, "I will never be out that worded again." And he wasn't. And he won. Are there some lessons? Maybe there are some lessons. Angry, meanwhile, says, "Hell, ask for folks to support an underground alternative media platform that'll actually challenge the nonsense in both parties by really building a new political reality." I'm serious, by the way. Oh, well, we ask for that. We ask for that support every evening. We're halfway there, by the way, thanks to an anonymous contributor. We got $50 to go this evening. In about 56 minutes or so. Up in the two-putt north, Ron says, "Someone, a long time ago, observed that good politics is a blood sport. Canadian politics, in general, is closer to a badminton game or lawn bowling." Jesus, that must be dull. I mean, what must it be like to have to live in a country where political elections are not the constant everyday grind that they are here? What do y'all talk about up there? Hockey? Yeah. Well, there's always the Grey Cup. Ron also asked, "Wasn't it Huey P. Long that stated loudly at a rally that I have it on good authority that my opponent is a confirmed heterosexual? Is that the kind of man we want for governor?" And the crowd yelled back, "No!" That's probably apocryphal too, but it makes sense. You'll never go broke underestimating the ignorance of the American voter. It's like that little prank gag that Penn and Teller played on that episode of whatever that thing is they did on Showtime or HBO a while back, where they sent, because they were making fun of the environmental movement, because climate change is all, you know, just so much bullshit, according to them. Of course, they're, you know, libertarians, and they don't care if the planet fucking melts as long as there's some money in it. Yeah, it's one of those not having a long view kind of things. But they sent a petition signing person through the crowd at a big environmental rally, asking people to sign off on a petition calling for a ban on hydrogen dioxide, otherwise known as H2O. And they got hundreds of signatures from well-meaning environmentalists at that rally in March in D.C. Checking back in with the mail, Matt in San Francisco, subject line, "Merman." Merman, Pop. Merman. Ethel Merman, "Oh, Bob, please bless your heart." And Matt further adds, "I truly believe if them Georgians came out to San Francisco for 6 months, we could turn them." Just saying. I bet, you know what, if they're Republicans coming out from Georgia, Matt, I don't think you're going to have, there's some of them you ain't going to have to work real hard, especially the Baptist preachers. Yeah, okay, thank you, Randy. Dihydrogen oxide. Yeah, not hydrogen dioxide. That would be HO2. Yeah. No, no, Matt, I don't think you'd have to work very hard at all. But, God, y'all are in misery, right? Didn't it get up to 90 in San Francisco the other day? That's unheard of. It's inconceivable. Yeah. Just got a recipe for roasting corn from Steve in Georgistan. Soak the ears in water in their husk for at least 30 minutes. Put on a hot grill. Put on hot grill. Soak an old bath towel in water. Wring out towel. Cover corn with wrung out bath towel. The towel won't burn, but it will get covered with soot, so make sure it's an old towel that's suitable for discard. If you like this method, you may want to save and reuse the same towel for future use. Cook the corn for 15 to 20 minutes. Turn ears about every 5 minutes or so. Remove the corn from the grill and pull back the husks. Wear oven mitts and watch out for the steam. Grilled corn tastes sweeter because the intense heat caramelizes the kernels. Enjoy. And again, with some of that fancy fancy European commie butter and some Old Bay, I'm right there. But there's also that microwave. It's that time of year, everybody. Corn on the cob time. There's also that microwave trick. And it works like you just, you know, trim the ends and trim the, and then just with the husk on, boom, in the microwave, 1 minute, pull it out, it's done. And the silks fall away, and then it's the butter and the Old Bay and happy. Let's see. Okay, we've got a spelling for that. I knew Michael would work on this. Michael and Madison, spell it like this, maybe. The Grouchy Meatheads is G-R umlaut O umlaut U C-H umlaut Y, all caps, M umlaut E T-H-H umlaut E-D-Z. I like that a lot. All I got to do now is figure out how to play an instrument and sing. Couldn't be too damn difficult, could it? So at 9 minutes past the hour or so, we've got $50 in fundraising yet to go, just to finish off the day. And by week's end, be paying some bills like a wild thing. What else? What else do we have out there this evening? Well, there's always you. With the exception of Clarity's call, this has been pretty much a filibobster this evening. If you've got anything on your mind, is there anything to say about Georgia 6th that hasn't already been said? Do you just want to holler, God damn it? Well, you can do that here. You know the number, 304-663-4676, 304-663-HORN, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178, and Skype to Skype from anywhere on the planet, Bob Kincaid Horn. See how easy it is? And by the way, here fairly soon, there will be a third phone line added. And it will be a hard line. And if we can raise the money for a little gizmo box, I'll bring it into the new mix desk, and that'll make three phone numbers and one Skype line. And so we'll have all kinds of possibility for those who want to engage in conversation. Now, there's a darn fine idea. Barkway in the chat room says, I'm waiting for a candidate who uses Make It So as a campaign rallying cry and get all those Trekkies in their corner. You know where that might be really handy? Scott mentioned last night how much San Francisco loves Comic-Con. Maybe that would be helpful in getting rid of one of those Republican San Diego members of the House of Representatives. Huh?
possibility.
Yeah. Make it so, number one.
Right. All right, then. All right, so we got that. Done with that. Oh, I ran across this earlier today. Every now and then, some Republican discovers ancient history. And it's always funny when it happens. Because we wander around in it here quite a lot, really. But back during Dim Leader's assault on the innocent people of Iraq, I remember reading about a cadre or contingent of Republicans who wanted to take a pagan approach, and this being the solstice, why not? Let's talk about it. Wanted to take a pagan approach to warfare. And said that our Christian values were getting in the way of us being able to really win wars real good. Yeah, either nobody listened or the idea just didn't quite have the starch they thought it did. Because we didn't exactly win Iraq now, did we? Yeah, we declared victory and ran away, but hi, ISIS. How about that? Michael Crowley writing today over at Politico, why the White House is reading Greek history. And even Politico, which of course Charlie Pierce refers to as Tiger Beat on the Potomac, and accurately so. Even Politico opens the article. The Trump White House isn't known as a hot spot for Ivy League intellectuals. But last month, the Harvard academic slipped into the White House complex for an unusual meeting. Graham Allison, an avuncular foreign policy thinker, I mean, this must be an important article, it's got avuncular in it, who served under Reagan and Clinton, was paying a visit to the National Security Council, where he briefed a group of staffers on one of history's most studied conflicts, a brutal war waged nearly 2,500 years ago, one whose lessons still resonate even in the administration of a president who doesn't like to read. Then can it, I mean, just asking here, can it really be said to have any resonance if the president doesn't want to know about it? Oh, no, I'm hearing great things about Thucydides. More and more people are saying Thucydides is doing great things. The subject of the White House meeting was America's rivalry with China, cast through the lens of ancient Greece. And I'll be the first one to say that it's awfully hard and rather dangerous business, intellectually speaking, to try to make one-to-one analogies with the ancient world and the modern. It is more comparative and contrastual than it is direct overlay. And that's where the pitfalls are. Because, frankly, we would not understand a member of the ancient world any more than they would understand us. And I'm not talking about language barriers. I'm talking about essential approaches to life. Jesus, an ancient Roman or an ancient Greek would think we had gone bughouse mad simply because women vote and participate in civil society and move freely. There's more of a close connection between, say, ancient Rome and modern Saudi Arabia than there is ancient Rome and modern Western culture. Because women had to be accompanied. And yes, women dressed head to toe, too, quite often. there were a couple of outliers, but for the most part, it wasn't just a hell of a lot of fun being female. That's why when a powerful woman rises up, she usually gets cast in the role of villain, whether it be Cleopatra or Livia, the wife of Octavian, or Boudica, who raised a rebellion in Britain. Or, as Angry and I discussed last night, the Amazons, who absolutely struck mortal terror into the hearts of the warrior male class in ancient Greece. Women are scary in the ancient world. And so naturally they get cast as whores and temptresses and witches. Oh, yeah. Unless they're being all meek and lammy, and, you know, then you get to be the Mother Mary, meek and mild. But anyway, the article says the subject was America's rivalry with China, cast through the lens of ancient Greece. The 77-year-old Allison is the author of a recent book based on the writings of Thucydides, the ancient historian famous for his epic chronicle of the Peloponnesian War between the Greek states of Athens and Sparta. Allison cites the Greek scholar's summation of why the two powers fought. What made war inevitable was the growth of Athenian power and the fear which this caused in Sparta. He warns that the same dynamic could drive this century's rising empire, China, and the United States into a war neither wants. Allison calls this the Thucydides trap, and it's a question haunting some very important people in the Trump administration, particularly as Chinese officials arrive Wednesday for diplomatic and security dialogue talks between Washington and Beijing, designed in large part to avoid conflict between the world's two strongest nations. Let's also remember, however, that in the form of racist Bannon, you have a guy who his withered old member jumps like a snake in the microwave at the very idea of war with China. He's hung up on it. He thinks that's where we're going. That's what we got to have, by God. And there are other right-wingers who get off on the notion, apparently not realizing that the entire population of the United States, not the entire United States military, that's a small, much smaller number, the entire population of the United States is a rounding error as compared to the entire population, or perhaps, you know, the military of China. The only way to ever win a war with China would be to engage in a nuclear exchange, at which point, you know, nobody wins. But Graham Allison fears a war with China that could sort of happen by accident. You know, kind of the way World War I did. It doesn't help that H.R. McMaster and Mad Dog Mattis are big Thucydides fans. You know, knowing your Thucydides without knowing context can be problematic. Graham Allison says, if you say to James Mattis, okay, how about the Melian dialogue, he could tell you exactly what it is. Well, groovy. And yes, Steve Bannon, racist Bannon, is another big fan of Thucydides. As Angry Indian points out, it's fucking dangerous. because when you're a right-winger like that, you're not reading Thucydides as a cautionary tale, but you're reading it because, cool, war. But guess what? In that scenario, we're the Athenians. And in that war, the Athenians lost everything. The Athenian democracy lasted maybe 200 years. Tops. Before it was all thrown away in a power lust driven decision to go to war. Go read the rest of the article over at Politico. You might find it informative. Oh dear. I take it Angry's talking about racist Bannon. Angry says, yeah, he likes Stalin too. Hey, we haven't had a nice conversation with John in Central PA in a while. Hey, John.
Hey, Bob. How you doing tonight?
I'm pretty good, really. Happy solstice to you.
Yeah, you're right back at you.
Thanks. Your card's in the mail.
Oh, okay. I'll be waiting for it. Last Friday, I know we were kind of tight on time, so there was a couple other things that I wanted to mention. At the time, like when I was talking to you on Friday on the front porch, I was kind of high. I smoked some weed before that. So I was,
well,
like,
lucky you.
Didn't know. Well, yeah, Fridays it usually, you know, I wait through the week.
Yeah, Friday's, you know, my day. Is that what we're saying? Friday's my day.
Yeah, right. That's usually the day, you know, pretty much the only day that I do it, because during the week, it's so busy, and you know, it's just kind of a thing where I just kick back and just let loose a little bit on Fridays, but. Yeah, I probably should have waited till after, because I was like, yeah, because I listened to the podcast the next day and I was like, oh, I didn't sound as weird as I thought I did at the time.
No, you were fine.
Yeah, I was like, yeah.
It's not like you opened your mouth and turned into a Pink Floyd album or anything. You were fine.
Right. Well, Steve, I wanted to address something that Steve from New York was talking about how Democrats don't know how to do politics. See, the problem, this is, I thought about this not even just that night, but for a while now, that I've noticed that our side of the political discussion cares about policy. They do not care about policy. They care about two things: winning, and they care about the political game. That's all they care about. I think the only,
well, they care about winning to the extent that it confers power. And then they care about, yes, the naked exercise of raw power.
Yes. And that's what the Democrats, they just, like, the leadership, and I'm not trying to sound like, you know, one of the unicorn sparkle fart people, but the leadership is practically non-existent. I mean, they, like, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are a joke. They're never on any of the Sunday shows trying to, you know, kind of rebut some of the things that the Republicans say. They're not on the Sunday shows trying to defend the Affordable Care Act or anything like that. They're nowhere to be found when this kind of legislative stuff is going down. And in the past, you know, with other leaders, like even Harry Reid, but he would get on the Sunday shows and he would fight for it a little bit. But they have no fight in them. You know, I think the Senate Majority Leader should be somebody like Al Franken. And minority leader, rather, and then the House minority leader should be somebody like Keith Ellison or anybody who is going to do something, because I mean the Republicans, of course, had a day of jubilee because they're talking about, oh, we got 5-0 on the special election seats, even though back when Obama first got in office, they only won like one special election seat. back then. It's not very common for the opposite party that just lost the election to gain seats that quick. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's
yeah,
not
sure.
Really, it's like Kellyanne, like, I don't understand why the, you know, not to flail here, but I don't understand why Kellyanne, like the modern day Republican Party is so goddamn mean. Like Kellyanne Conway tweeted, laughing my ass off right now. Get it? Ass off? Yeah, and it's just like...
Oh, she had been waiting and waiting and waiting to get to use that line.
Right. And I'm sure, yeah, you're probably right. She probably thought of that. Probably took her, you know, half a brain. You know, I don't know.
Couldn't have taken more than half a brain because it's much as she got.
Right, exactly. And I was about to say, it took all her brain capacity that she could possibly muster up to think of something like that, even though I'm sure somebody else said it first. And I just see normal people or normal politicians would say congratulations to the win, to, you know, Karen Handel, who is apparently dumber than a fucking bag of sticks, you know, and John Ossoff, good job. You know, we like John McCain in the last election, you know, for what he is, we all know how he is, but he said, I mean, he still has a little bit of respect because he tweeted about I think the woman's name was Kirk Patrick or something like that, was running against him last year, and he said, want to thank all my supporters and all the voters for reelecting me, and I want to also thank Kirk Patrick. She had a good run or whatever, you know, kind of just gave her a little bit of a a professional courtesy, if you will. And
right.
These people, these Trumpian people, they don't do that. They just, they're so mean and hateful and miserable that they just, they don't even think about that kind of stuff because they're unintelligent for one thing, you know, and it's just, it's sickening. And to be honest with you, it angers me. It puts rage into me. And that's why I find it very suspect when members of the Republican Party are going around saying that the Democrats need to tone down their rhetoric when these people are the ones who do stuff like that, where they deliberately piss people off on purpose and stoke outrage. And they wonder why they're, you know, why we hate them, you know. It's and I understand. Yes, there is people on our side of the political spectrum that are violent. There is some. I mean, I remember
it is a violent country.
Yes. Right. Well, I remember reading stories during the election about people that were basically waiting outside of Trump rallies and assaulting Trump supporters. It didn't happen often, and sometimes Trump's, and we all know everything that Trump supporters did too. They were violent too. It's on both sides, but it's like one thing happens for one nut takes a shot at a person in the Republican Party, and all of a sudden we're these violent, super violent liberals. And it's funny because I seem to remember when Gene Forte put his hands around a reporter's neck, they were cheering that on. You see what I'm saying? So it's all right for them to do what they want to liberals because we're not real Americans.
Right. And when they say, goddamn Democrats need to tone it down, what happens, John? We on this side have a sudden attack of navel gazing.
Well, you know, maybe we should tone it down. Maybe we've been just a little bit harsh. I mean, maybe we've been a little too mean to them.
A long time ago, before you began listening to the program, I used to tell the story of what would happen when it was molasses-making time and how the cane would be ground in a mill, a mule on a track, just walking in circles, turning the mill, feeding the grain in, squeezing out the juice, and you take the juice and you boil it down and you get molasses out of it. But along the way, you scoop off this foam at the top, okay? And a lot of the times the foam would it's not usable, and so they just scoop off that foam and throw it in an old holler stump. And through the course of the making, the stump, the hollowed out stump, would fill up. And after the making, you go away, and a few days later, people would come back, and you know, it'd have like dead yellow jackets and wasps and bees and flies and shit in it. And you skim that stuff off and drink it, and you'll get drunker than shit. Stump liquor.
Must be a Southern thing.
And
I've never heard of that.
And you get mean, fighting, hateful drunk. And I used to refer to the Republicans as the Stump Liquor Bunch. And the Stump Liquor Bunch and the Stump Liquor Bunch will look at you and say things like, you know, you're being kind of uncivil. And we say, oh, we're terribly sorry. And before we can get sorry out, they've kicked us in the nuts, punched us in the guts, and elbowed us in the head and got us to ground. And then they start kicking and stomping and saying, this'll teach you some goddamn civility. This'll teach you how to talk to your betters. And laugh and laugh. You want us to quit kicking you? Yes, please. And then they kick you some more till they got your teeth out of you. And
that's about the size of it.
That's the Republicans versus the Democrats. So, no, there was no navel gazing here. I damned well won't do it. If those scumbags deserve the criticism that's levied at them, levy it. I don't advocate for violence here, but I'm damned well not going to sit around and say, oh, well, maybe we were, you know, a little bit unpleasant. Gosh, I tell you what, can we have a sensitivity session and sing a few choruses of Kumbaya, and maybe we'll all understand each other? Bullshit!
All right. That's exactly the size of it. And that's why people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, as leaders of the party in the Congress, needed to get in front of it and say, look, and I know Nancy Pelosi kind of did a little bit. You know, she made some comments, but she should have said, oh, that's funny. How come were they speaking out against Gianforte, putting his hands around somebody's neck?
Nope, sorry. There was no need for Republicans to dial back their violent rhetoric when that happened. There was no need for them to stop screaming Lugenpresse. Oh hell no.
Right, and that's why. Well, you mentioned yesterday the people that jumped up onto the stage at Hamilton, or not Hamilton, at the Caesar, and I looked into the one woman that did that.
Oh, she's a troll.
She's Alex Jones. She's been on Alex Jones a couple of times in a show. She is a right wing filth. She's this blonde haired, big titted woman who is just typical right wing, you know, asshole. Basically, she's
easy with the anatomical references. I mean, this is just me talking to you, okay? We can say blonde. We can't refer to her breast size.
Okay, all right, sorry. But no, I'm just saying that, like, a lot of, for some reason...
Well, no, I'm sure, no, but no, look, yeah, that plays with Republicans, and they travel in it, and what's her name, the anti-Muslim Islamophobe, Pamela Geller.
Pam Geller?
Yeah, she's forever posting pictures of her cleavage and trying to traffic in it and trying to make money off her, you know, her appearance. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure that there's a whole bunch of fanboys out there who are typing responses to their posts with one hand on the keyboard and one hand, well, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, this woman here is disgusting. She's really going hard about this liberal violence stuff, you know, and they are. That's why when I heard that the shooter was a liberal or not, he's not a liberal, okay? He's just a person that, you know, is like Bernie for whatever reason, supposedly, though. I don't even fully believe that. just as if a Republican went and shot a Democrat and said, "Oh, well, he was all about Trump." I wouldn't believe it at face value or anything. You know what I mean? I would want to see some evidence. And yeah,
okay, this is just always at hand for me. His last name was Adkisson, not Hodgkinson in this case. Adkisson. And he committed murders inside, this was many years ago now. He committed murders inside the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church. And he did the world the kindness of providing a manifesto before he left, or before he went on his killing spree. And it was handwritten, and he said, "I guess you're wondering why I did this. Well, let me explain in detail. Over the years, I've had some good jobs, but I always got laid off. Now I'm 58 years old, and I can't get a decent job. I'm told I'm overqualified, which is a code word for too damned old. Like I'm expected to age gracefully into poverty. No thanks, I'm done." And you know what? The economic anxiety people out there would look at a paragraph like that and go, "That's the kind of guy that Bernie was reaching out to. That's the kind of economic anxiety that Hillary failed to address. That's the sort of thing that we can build our future on." And he continues, "I've always wondered why I was put on the earth. For years I thought I was put here to die as a cannon fodder in Vietnam, but somehow cheated the devil out of it. Lately, I've been feeling helpless in our war on terrorism, but I realized I could engage the terrorist allies here in America, the best allies they've got, the Democrats. The Democrats have done everything they can do to tie our hands in this war on terror. They're all a bunch of traitors. They want America to loose this war for reasons I cannot understand. It makes me so mad. In a parallel train of thought, it saddens me to think back on all the bad things that liberalism has done to this country. The worst problem America faces today is liberalism. They have dumbed down education. They have defined deviancy down. Liberals have attacked every major institution that made America great. From the Boy Scouts to the military, from education to religion, the major news outlets have become the propaganda arm of the Democrat Party. Liberals are evil. They embrace the tenets of Karl Marx. They're Marxist socialist communists." And then he goes off on the Unitarian Church. Know
wow.
This, if nothing else. One, this was a hate crime. I hate the damn left-wing liberals. There's a vast left-wing conspiracy in this country, and these liberals are working together to attack every decent and honorable institution in the nation, trying to turn this country into a communist state. Shame on them, too. Now, remember, the guy goes in and commits murder inside a church, all right? During a youth production of Annie. Two, this was a political protest. I'm protesting the liberal Supreme Court justices forgive the terrorists at Gitmo constitutional rights. I'm protesting the major news outlets ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, PBS for being the propaganda wing of the Democrat Party. It's criminal what they're getting away with. They're traitors. They must be stopped. I'm protesting the DNC running such a radical leftist candidate, Osama Hussein Obama, yo mama. No experience, no brains, a joke. Dangerous to America. Hell, he looks like Curious George. Three. This was a symbolic killing. Who I wanted to kill was every Democrat in the Senate and House, the 100 people in Bernard Goldberg's book. I'd like to kill everyone in the mainstream media, but I knew these people were inaccessible to me. I couldn't get to the generals and high-ranking officers of the Marxist movement, so I went after the foot soldiers, the chicken shit liberals that vote in these traitorous people. Someone had to get the ball rolling. I volunteered. I hope others do the same. It's the only way we can rid America of this cancerous pestilence. Sincerely, Jim
wow.
David Adkisson. He goes on for a bit. Now, when they went into his house, they found Liberalism is a Mental Disorder by Michael Savage. They found Bernard Goldberg's list of the 100 liberals who are killing America. They found books by Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh. And the fucker had been weaponized as sure as if he had had a key turned in him and handed the gun. But liberals need to tone it down, John.
That's just like a bunch of, like, the guy that shot the George Tillerson guy, the guy that went and shot up the Planned Parenthood, like a couple years ago. All that kind of stuff. You're right. They have weaponized. And what's happening, what you saw with the guy that did the shooting last week was basically a reaction. It might not have been direct, but it was a reaction to this, to what they're doing. And if I was leadership if I was Democratic Party leadership, I would say, how about you tone down your agenda? How about you make your agenda stop alienating people that didn't vote for you, and try to work for everybody, not just
understand now that we know that chinless Mitch McConnell is getting ready to drop his little turd on the body politic, the so-called healthcare bill, which isn't a healthcare bill, it's just a goddamn tax cut. Well, one thing, right. because of what happened to Klan sympathizer Steve Scalise, again, that's not a criticism, that's just a factual reference. That's like saying right. What happened to Louisiana State University fan Steve Scalise. It's just factual. Because of what happened, the one thing that most desperately will need to be said about this godforsaken travesty about to be visited on the American people will not be said, John, because the one thing that needs to be said is that any Republican member of the Senate who votes for this health care bill will be voting to kill tens of thousands of innocent American citizens. Period. End of sentence. No further debate. Because we know that that is what the outcome of this legislation will do. It's not maybe. It's not possibly. It's not, you know, if it happens on a day with an R in it. This health care bill will serve as a sentence of death to tens of thousands of American citizens. And because of what happened in Alexandria, if anybody raises that issue, they will be screamed down both by the right and by the civility chorus of the for-profit media and some of the kumbaya chorus of the Democratic Party for making the debate needlessly harsh. You know what's harsh, John? Fucking dying because you can't get health care.
Because of...
Sorry, I'm not barking at you, man. You know that.
Oh, I know.
You just kind of... You kind of lit me up.
This is for, right? You know?
Yeah. So...
Because... Unlike these.
Hey, John, I don't know why, brother, but you're breaking up. I don't know if it's your internet or mine, but I'm getting like one syllable in 20 at this point. But it's awful good talking to you.
On your end, too.
Yeah, okay, sorry. So we will continue this conversation at a later date, okay? I'll take that for a yes. Thanks, John. I appreciate the call, and like I said, we'll talk again soon. In the chat room, Barkway says, dang, Bob, I'd never heard that manifesto before. Frightening. It's terrifying. Mike Yu says, strangling the reporter. The reporter that got a hand to the neck, it kind of sounds like a threat on their life. If the reporter concealed carried, could they have shot the one attempting to strangle? You're damn skippy. only then they would have screamed to get a rope out in Montana because, you know, he was one of those Eastern elite left-wing journalists. And, of course, no good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, amosexual, young earth creationist could ever be thought to threaten, be an actual threat to somebody's life when they had their hands around their neck. Well, hell no. Let's run out to Oregon and check in on the stress line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Paul from Parts Unknown. Am I coming in okay?
You're coming in great, Paul. Good to hear from you.
Ah, thanks. Yeah, it's been a while. It's hard to find time to call you on the left coast here because your show ends at, you know, 6 o'clock our time.
Right, and right there at the end of your work day and the beginning of supper.
Yeah. I just wanted to call in to bounce one of my worries off you and see if it's valid or not, which is that I'm slightly worried about constantly picking on the voters in 2016 that voted for Jill Stein that cost Hillary Clinton the election. Maybe they did, but maybe they didn't. But I keep flashing back to the 2000 election with George W. Bush about how angry people were for the Ralph Nader's vote for the voters who voted for Ralph Nader, and how that cost, quote unquote, cost him the election in Florida. And the next 4 years, there was a lot of, you know, well, we wouldn't be going to Iraq and 9/11 wouldn't happen if people just didn't vote for Ralph Nader and voted for Al Gore. And after 4 years of the Ralph Nader voters being good and yelled at, they figured that that would solve the problem. And then 2004 comes along and George Bush gets a second term. And yes, Ralph Nader ran again, but he didn't get on the ballot as in many states, and he didn't get anywhere near as many votes as he did in 2000. But that obviously wasn't the problem.
No, I mean, I think Paul, 2000 and 2004 are in their own way sui generis. Just like the Supreme Court said about their Bush v. Gore decision, you know, this is a one off. By 2004. I think there's a general understanding, at least on our side now, that election was lost in Ohio, and it was lost as a result of you know, straight up election tampering. The other part of the Nader issue in 2000 is the fact that you had other ifs involved in the process, like back then West Virginia was not a red state. Back then, West Virginia was one of the few states that voted for Michael Dukakis and, you know, George McGovern. And if West Virginia had simply voted for Al Gore the way they had predictably voted for other Democratic nominees, the 5 votes that would have been gotten in West Virginia would have meant Florida didn't matter at all. And the same can be said for Tennessee, Gore's home state. So I think there's a shade of difference there. I get your concern about beating on the Stein voters, and I've tried to leave them alone for a while, but when I saw that article yesterday with the one Stein supporter saying I'm kind of giggling about Trump being president now. Yeah, that's one person, but still, it's kind of a pisser because there's not a lot to giggle about with 23 million people on the verge of losing their health care. You know what I mean?
No, there's not. It's just that, Greg Palast wrote a book talking about the voter purging, and he's made a good argument that cost Hillary Clinton the election more votes than the Jill Stein cost her in Michigan and
Wisconsin.
Michigan, Wisconsin. And,
Wisconsin in particular.
Wisconsin, Ohio.
Yeah, Wisconsin in particular.
And so it's my, you know, my worry is, yeah, they're different scenarios, I agree, but my worry is we're going to, you know, just say everyone get behind whomever the Democratic candidate is and don't vote third party, and that's going to solve our problem. And that seemed to be kind of a strategy that John Kerry's campaign took, and there were other issues, you're right, but I didn't think, you know, that George Bush would walk into a second term. There was just no way before 2004. And I'm now, you know, once bitten, twice shy, kind of going, we could have two terms of Donald Trump if we can't address the real issues.
Well, I hate to be a little ray of sunshine, but I fully expect him to win a second term.
Say again?
I fully expect Trump, if he's still around in 2020, I expect him to win re-election.
Oh, that is depressing.
And if we can, I mean, I've tried to moderate back from the use of, you know, sparkle fart powered unicorn cavalry purity brigade. I used it tonight. I'm sorry. But the one kernel remains, doesn't it, Paul? And that is that there's always somebody out there who isn't pure enough. And I mean, I experience it here. If I say that Angus King and Kamala Harris did a good job cross-examining some member of the Trump administration, I immediately get emails telling me how ideologically impure Angus King and Kamala Harris are on issues that have absolutely nothing to do with the issue that was at hand in the hearing.
Yeah, and I don't agree with the whole purity test either, but can we downshift from a purity test to a passing grade test? I'll take a C-plus progressive candidate or higher.
Well, I mean, exactly, and you're
pretty low.
And you're answering the question that I asked earlier about the South Carolina race. You had a Democratic nominee who was a former executive for Goldman Sachs come within 3 points of beating the Republican for an open seat. Now, would it have been better to have had that Democrat, that guy with the D behind his name, who was a former Goldman Sachs executive, in that seat than having another wild-eyed Republican, you know, Trumpansy teabagger? I tend to come down on the answer, yes. But I don't know, and right there, I mean, right there is your C-plus Democrat, okay? But
I haven't looked into that individual thoroughly to where he stands on the issues, but who knows? We might have a different line than I do. Hearing those facts makes me want to research what his stances are.
Well, I think he would probably be qualified as a moderate to conservative Democrat. In other words, the kind of Democrat that might have a fighting chance in a district like that. Because and I realize, you know, you're where you are, I'm where I am. It's a different thing to run as a Democrat in Massachusetts than to run as a Democrat in Alabama. They might both have D's behind their names, but they are different animals.
I can accept that. I can accept that, but at the same time, we need to. I wonder if that's what they said during the progressive era of the early 20th century.
Look, Social Security was passed as a law with no Republican votes. And Social Security was passed as a law with exclusively Democrat votes. And the South was crawling with Democrats who were racist as hell. And that's why the earliest versions of Social Security did everything under the sun to try to make sure that people of color did not receive it. But we were able to put fixes in as time went on. That doesn't excuse their racism, but I think it kind of addresses the question you asked about the progressive era of the 20th century.
I'm actually more focusing on the trust-busting era of
TR?
Teddy Roosevelt. Yeah, because that's in my head, that's where we are. We're up against a big business that's got way too much influence on politics. That's corrupting the system. And, you know, we got an income tax passed. We got a direct election of senators. And we broke up. We passed the Sherman Antitrust Act. Theodore Roosevelt broke up, I think, Standard Oil. He only broke up one or two big monopolies. And then Taft came in behind him and really broke a lot of them up. And that's kind of what we need. And Reagan came in and said, we're no longer enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. Can a new president come in and say, we're enforcing it now? Is it just that easy?
Well, I mean, the law's still on the books.
Yeah.
But, of course, there's 100 years of Supreme Court precedent on it, too.
Well, I think the current court's proved that stare decisis isn't, in stone.
Right. Well, sure. But, even the progressive movement of the late 1800s and early 1900s was a sort of short-lived. And let's remember, that was a movement driven by people who at that point in time called themselves Republicans. Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. Because political ideologies shift within within the party dynamics, so that by the time FDR comes around, his cousin, progressivism is something that Democrats do, because there was a right wing conservative backlash against Teddy Roosevelt, who, by the way, Teddy Roosevelt's a classic case study in ideological purity, because the man was racist as hell. He believed in, he was like the high archbishop of American imperialism.
True.
He was racist, and the things that we would excoriate today, but. That's one of the things, and Charlie Pierce has pointed this out, a whole lot of populism, given its head, will devolve into nativism, racism, and bigotry, because it requires the activity and the excitement and the enthusiasm of people who are not necessarily, and I hate to sound like an elitist in saying this, Paul, but sophisticates. They know they're not getting enough to eat. They know they're not getting paid enough, and they will therefore act accordingly. But then you have to deal with the biases and bigotries that come with it.
That could be the issue on both sides of the aisle, then, in terms of modern day populism on the right and the left. That could explain the chimpanzee, that I also explained the purity test.
I think it does, but the purity brigade on our side, so to speak, tends not to come from that working class background. As we found out through statistical analysis, it wasn't that the working class turned their back on Hillary. It was the middle class and a whole bunch of women. And that's another bit of navel gazing. Unfortunately, Paul, I got to get out of here because I didn't get to you in time for this conversation to go as far as it should. I hope at some point in time we can extend it, if you'll be so kind as to let me intrude into your dinner hour.
Oh, it's not my dinner hour; it's my work hour. I got off early. I've been working long hours. So yeah, if I get another opening, I'll definitely call back in.
All right, thanks, Paul. You take care. Bye
now. Bye-bye.
Paul from Parts Unknown, and a great conversation. Hey, I got to get out of here. We'll finish. Thank you, Anonymous. We'll finish with $50 to go in fundraising this evening. Otherwise, tomorrow it's $250 for Thorn in the Side Thursday. Thanks, everybody. Thanks Midweek Utility Chat Room moderator Steve from Georgistan. Thanks, News Ninjas, John Fox, Ben Birch, and Cold River Mountain Watch, and always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.